It's an open forum on climate change held right on the banks of the St. John's River. We'll take your calls and questions just ahead. Good Tuesday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. The show is always live on the radio at 9, but never miss a show. Our podcast is now up every day on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, we want your calls as a JU climate expert joins the show. What are your questions, especially when it comes to Florida impacts? The number to join us, 549-2937. Then later, marking the Freedom Trail in St. Augustine, part of our America's First City series. Plus, we'll tell you why magic spells are taking over downtown Jacksonville this week. All of that and more ahead. But first this morning, it's billed as an open dialogue on what we know and don't know about climate change. This week, Jacksonville University and the local chapter of the United Nations Association are sponsoring this open forum on climate, discussing greenhouse gases to sea level rise and more. This is timely. Researchers reported Monday in the journal Nature Climate Change that temperature swings can kill, and not just with heat waves. Climate experts around the world agree that the world's overall temperature is headed upwards, but that doesn't mean that every place is getting steadily warmer. Climate change is also making the weather more variable, causing hotter summers, colder winters in some places, and more severe storms. So, what can we glean from this latest research? And in particular, how will climate change affect Florida with our thousands of miles of coastline? Well, here with a preview of Wednesday's event, we welcome Dr. Jeremy Stalker of JU's Marine Science Research Institute. Dr. Stalker, good morning.
Good morning.
And we're already getting your calls. We want your calls and questions on this topic, climate change, what we know and don't know, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet us, or you can also comment on Facebook. Dr. Stalker, this is coming up Wednesday at the River House on the JU campus, free to the public. Tell us about this event.
But what's really billed is an informative event to have people start talking about some of the effects, what they need to know, what they don't know, what they've heard. So it really is sort of an open forum on coming and discussing some of the effects we're seeing from a shifting climate.
And let's talk about what you study as an ocean geologist and the effects that we're already feeling here in Florida, particularly in South Florida.
Okay, well, generally as a scientist these days, as a natural scientist, you're sort of a jack of all trades in some ways. You have to have an understanding of multiple different disciplines. And my particular focuses are on isotope studies. So I sort of mingle in all sorts of things from migration of animals to paleoclimate. So sort of an overview of how what tools we can use to really depict how the system is changing and look at some of the baselines.
And what are you seeing?
So we see some distinctive shifts, and we're not talking instant shifts. We're talking slow, gradual changes. And that's really some of the insidious ways that climate change works, is the changes you see are gradual. And the best analogy I have is, if you look at yourself in a mirror from one day to the next, you don't really see a whole lot of change from your face from, you know, Tuesday to Wednesday. But if you look at a picture of yourself, you know, 10 years ago, and you look at a picture of yourself now, the differences are stark. And that's sort of how climate works. So the weather shifts we see are that day-to-day mirror value, whereas the climate shifts we see are that long-term sort of, if you will, the picture value.
And if you're just tuning in, JU ocean geologist Dr. Jeremy Stalker in studio now previewing JU's event Wednesday night on the campus, Climate Change, What We Know and Don't Know. We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. So what are some real-world examples of these gradual changes you're observing?
Well, we can see some, I mean, the most dramatic effects we see here in Florida are things related to sea level rise. As the temperature in the globe increases, and it is called, I guess I should sort of work through these two terms, global warming versus climate change, and they really are the same thing. Climate change, as it suggests, is differences in temperature shifts and precipitation and weather patterns, things like that that happen on a local value. Whereas global warming is an increase in temperature of the global system. And that in temperature increase is what's causing the climate shifts. So one of those effects is sea level rise, and we've been hearing a lot about that lately because it's one of the most tangible effects that we can see visually, especially if you live on a coastline. So changes we see in Florida, if you live in Miami, it's a very, very in your front yard, as it were, especially Miami Beach, which now floods, not just on the highest tides of the year, but it's starting to flood parts of the city during just regular high tides. And these are systems we built. The drainage systems generally in that city were built as gravity systems. So water flows from the streets out into the ocean during heavy rainfall. And as the sea level comes up, that gravity system doesn't work anymore, and the seawater basically moves up through the drainage pipes into the streets. And this kind of shift is going to become more common in these coastal areas. You'll see erosion, beach erosion. Beach houses are going to start to see, you know, as much as you, sand as you put out in front to keep your beach there. As the sea level rises, it's gonna disappear.
Paint a picture for listeners 20 years from now, 25, 30 years from now.
There are things we do know we're going to see. You're going to start seeing more, let's say you live in Atlantic Beach or Jacksonville Beach or Ponte Vedra, you're going to start seeing more and more beach erosion. And it'll come in chunks sometimes when you have nor'easters come by. The sand will move. Basically, all those municipalities are built on a barrier island. That barrier island wants to move with sea level. So as the sea comes up, the sand normally in a natural system overwashes during storms, and it slowly moves that barrier island inland. But we fixed it, so what's going to we're going to start seeing is that fixed beach is going to start disappearing. And what if you own beach property, you're going to start seeing more and more erosion. And things like water supply is another issue. If you have coastal cities that depend on groundwater, saltwater intrusion is going to start fouling some of those wells that are near shore. You're going to start having to look further inland for your water resources.
What's the worst case scenario?
The doomsday scenarios, and there are some unknowns that we're really not in great control of, are things like how quickly ice sheets, like the Greenland ice sheet or the Antarctic ice sheet, which are very, very far away from Florida, but affect us in terms of that overall sea level value. We don't have a great handle on how quickly those things will disappear. If it's a catastrophic collapse, in other words, the entire sheet disappears into the water, that'll raise sea level very quickly. Those doomsday scenarios where we see those ice sheets collapse, especially the Greenland ice sheet, would see a sea level rise of closer to, 10, 15 feet, which then that starts disappearing parts of downtown Jacksonville. You'll start to see parts of Ortega disappear. So if you can look at these sea level rise scenarios, the doomsday scenarios see significant chunks of Florida coastline, Louisiana coastline, and if you think further abroad, places like Bangladesh, a huge population that lives in a very low-lying area, those people are going to have to move somewhere as the ocean basically encroaches on what used to be drier land.
Do you agree with those doomsday scenarios, or do you think they're alarmist?
I don't think alarmist is the right word. The science is still out there, and in some ways the cryogenic sciences about the ice sheets is behind. Not to knock researchers who are doing that. It's just we haven't spent a lot of money and time studying those things because they've been sort of permanent in our eyes. We now know more that they aren't permanent, that they do shift through time. So I don't think they're alarmist. I think that we need more information before we can really, either say it's going to or not happen. But we do know that the Greenland ice sheet is melting and disappearing. We do know that the Antarctic glacial ice sheet is disappearing and losing mass. So we see the changes in one direction, and that direction happens to be towards more loss as opposed to the more conservative values where they're actually staying more stable.
What is your opinion on the new study out Monday that I referenced at the top of the hour, looking at the health effects of climate change, that wild variable swings in temperature produce more deaths, especially among senior citizens?
So, we know that the direct effects you get from climate change into health are going to be things like heat stroke or the dry dehydration, these direct effects. I think those are not going to be large. There are not a lot of people who are going to die from the direct effects. It's going to be the indirect effects, the loss of food production, the loss of water resources for power, loss of water resources for drinking water. Those sort of secondary effects are going to be much more dramatic. I also read a paper about a month ago about malaria and the malarial-carrying mosquitoes. As temperature increases, their range of where they can live increases. So we're watching malaria creep up the sides of mountains in South America because the temperature is increasing up the sides of the mountains. And that places in the southern United States are already worrying about some diseases that were formerly very tropical that are now moving into places where they weren't traditionally even thought of.
What would you say to those listening who would classify themselves as climate change skeptics? They don't believe this issue is dire. They don't agree with the consensus that seems to be near universal now among the scientific community that the climate is warming and that man's actions as related to greenhouse gases are a contributing factor.
I feel complex about that. There's some of you that's very sympathetic because it's a very hard, large, complex system to get your head around. So understanding all the different pieces of science that go into what we're really building as this climate change scenario, it's really hard to understand. It's gleaning pieces here and there. It's some of it can be contradictory. But as these processes work together, and these contradictory processes work together, what we start to see is a bigger picture. I guess what I would say is part of it is becoming informed. So part of it's learning what you need to know. And part of it is really getting past a lot of the social stigmas that come with thinking about climate change and not wanting these things to happen. And nobody wants, you know, mass starvation and sea level rise and people to start feeling these effects. Nobody wants to think about their children having to deal with effects that they're not going to have to deal with. So I'm sympathetic on that level. On the other level, just because it's you're denying it's happening, that you don't want to believe in it, that's not the way science works. It's what we're seeing. It's an observational sort of premise that we're seeing.
And we'll go to your calls right now on JU's climate change panel coming up tomorrow night on the JU campus. What are your questions? What are your thoughts? 549-2937. Bill in Mandarin. Go ahead, Bill.
Yes, the reason I call him a bit of a historian, and for example, I read where when Leif Erikson and the Vikings were traveling across the North Atlantic, Greenland today, back then, was quite warm because they called it Vineland, grow grapes. What is that? Have you been studying saying what the water sea level was at that time versus today and that kind of thing?
All right. Thanks, Bill.
That's a great question. Actually, I love Viking history. That was during a time we called the medieval warm period, which is a warming related to solar activity and some of our the way the Earth sort of wobbles through space. And what they saw was an increase in temperature. And strangely enough, we've actually passed that medieval warm temperature today. So modern temperatures today are past even that medieval warm period. And what they did see is a much warmer time when there was a breakup of a lot of the northern sea ice masses. The sea ice extent from the Arctic Ocean was much farther north, which allowed the Vikings to sort of move through this northern section all the way to Newfoundland. And then as we went from that medieval ice age, we sort of wobbled back into a cooler period called the Little Ice Age, and that basically shut down that Viking route of I guess, trade and settlement. And we saw sort of a places like Greenland becoming much smaller, and we saw Newfoundland basically disappearing as a Viking outpost. So those are sort of natural variations that we see in our climate from perturbations in our orbit and some of our solar activity. But those sort of shifts in temperature are much smaller compared to things that we're seeing today. And the speed at which they happen over 1,000 years is very different than the speed we're seeing through hundreds of years today. So sea levels would have been probably a little bit higher. That data there is much less, you know, succinct. It's a little more unsure, but there the uncertainty around it is not so great that we can't say that sea level was higher. And we did see much less ice. But the temperatures, global temperatures, were still lower, even during the medieval warm period. That was very a local effect in the northern hemisphere. We don't see the same sorts of effects in places like Australia, New Zealand, or southern Africa. So it was a very different way. It wasn't a global warming. It was a very localized northern hemisphere warming.
549-2937, Ed in Clay County. Hi, Ed. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I look forward to going to the Wednesday forum. It sounds fantastic. Question. I think the confusion that a lot of people have is that when we look at the projections on our own weather, whether it's next week or how many hurricanes we're going to have next year, it seems to be a very much of a hit and miss situation. We have the weather expert have missed the number of hurricanes and to hit Florida for the last 6 years, completely missed the mark. Orange Park, which is where I'm calling from, 100 years ago was called Orange Park because it had orange grove. It was warmer. And then the citrus line moved down south because of the freezes that we had up here. The Mayan civilization will wipe out by changes in weather. And we can keep going like that. You mentioned the Middle Ages, the Little Freeze. Also during the Roman time, Britain was a producer of wine. It was almost like a Mediterranean weather. So the question, I guess, is how much can we trust the numbers, how accurate those projections are?
Thanks, Ed. And that's a common refrain you hear from people following this, saying when they look at historical events, they have some skepticism about this latest scientific data. What about that?
So we're confusing in some ways local effects from global effects. So I've heard the wine argument in Britain before, and actually they're still growing wine grapes in Britain today. They're actually producing more wine grapes today in Britain than they even did during the Middle Ages. And the Mayan civilization, that's a really interesting topic if you're an archaeologist. There's some indications that we were in extreme drought. And what the Mayan civilization did is it didn't disappear. It just retracted back south to where it was wetter, where you could still produce the amount of agriculture you need for those cultural centers. So in some ways, those are built on more local effects from a global variation. So the projections, if you want, look at the IPCC reports and you look at the lines that disappear off into time to 2100 and beyond, you'll see a wide range of values for things like sea level rise. That uncertainty is built on the modeling. So things that we do know really well about how the climate system works, there are things we don't know really well about how the climate system works. And I'm sure there are things out there we're discovering as scientists that we didn't know, if you will. So there's some uncertainty built on our understanding even of the Earth system. So if you think about this, climate science is parts of it are older, but as a discipline, it's very, very young. So there are a number of things that we don't have great certainty about. And that's where we get some of that uncertainty built into our big climate projections. The weather argument, that's sort of a difficult one to deal with in some ways. Yes, so they say it's going to have a 50% chance of rain tomorrow. That's a pretty good prediction. They can't predict exactly where it's going to rain because that's built on much more localized effects of rising air and where the trees are and what the prevailing wind is. But the overall forecasts are actually quite good. It's the exact changes that are very difficult to predict. And it's the same thing with climate change. We know the general trends of where things are headed, but the exact values of what are going to happen are going to be much more difficult until you start getting closer to that event horizon, if you will.
But since the forum is called What We Know and What We Don't Know, what do you, Dr. Jeremy Stocker, know about climate change? What can you say with certainty?
The Earth is getting warmer. The oceans are getting warmer. The ocean is acidifying. These are all things that we see. The sea levels are going up. We have instrument records that can and basically verify that. So we know some very generalized values. The amount of temperature rise, that's going to be in question because we don't have a great handle on how we're producing greenhouse gases in the future. So if we start to tailor off the amount of fossil fuels we use, if we continue at, you know, at business today, the same levels, or as what we're seeing is more populations around the world become globalized and get access to fossil fuels and cars and things like that, an increase in CO2 production. All those things are going to affect these temperature values. So we know the temperature will go up. We're just not entirely sure how much. A lot of it's based on these different scenarios. We know that sea level is going up. We know that our ocean is getting more acidic, which makes it difficult for some animals to basically live. And it makes it easier for other animals to live. So I can tell you those things. The exact timing of the Greenland ice sheet melting, the exact amount of sea level rise, those are going to be much harder. So nailing down an exact number, that's the difficult part. That's why we give ranges. It's the same thing with hurricane forecasting. So when you get the cone of certainty, if you've ever been on a coastline looking at the cone of certainty, it's never fun to be in that cone, but you also know that that cone shifts around. It's the same idea because there are very, very instant effects that could change that we may not be able to predict very well. Hopefully that answers it.
Yeah. Sure. And here's another question for you from our Facebook page. Is it true that it takes hundreds of years for CO2 to be removed from the atmosphere? Doesn't that mean that even if we stopped adding greenhouse gases today, the climate will continue to change? Does that mean we will have to do something to remove CO2 from our atmosphere?
That's a great question. And that's one of those topics that I bring up when I teach my course. If we stopped everything today, so we shut down all the lights, we all stopped driving, we all stopped producing CO2 all around the world, it would take 1,000 years for that CO2 to work its way out of the atmosphere through these natural biological systems, through the ocean, back into the sediments, back into fossil fuels. It would take 1,000 years for that CO2 to be removed back to pre-industrial levels, so back to when we were, colonial times, if you will. So if it's one of these legislation problems, because what you're doing is we're really working on problems we're never going to see the results from. And that's the difficult part, is even if whatever we do today, you and I, sitting here in this studio, we're not going to see that change. Our children, our grandchildren, our grandchildren's grandchildren's grandchildren, they're the ones that would see the effects of our legislation. The best example is CFCs. If you remember back in the 1980s, CFCs were destroying the ozone layer. So we legislated to remove CFCs from most aerosols, from spray cans. Only now, almost, 40, 50 years later, we're starting to see the ozone layer stop growing, or the hole stop growing and start to repair itself. So legislators that were in Congress that made that decision may have died and never seen the effects of that legislation. That's one of the hurdles we have as a society, is to deal with that sort of long-term thinking when we're a very short-term thinking species in a lot of ways.
Here's a tweet from a listener. What about the mini ice age expected to hit around 2030 that's trending on social media? I've seen reports about that too.
Yeah, I'm trying to say this nicely. It's based on some misinterpretations of science. The mini ice age that we're headed for, if you remember back in the 70s, there was a lot of news headlines about we're going to global cooling because temperatures were decreasing. Well, we now know during that time, the thought process was we were in this interglacial period. We've really hit the extent where historically through geologic time, we should be heading back towards an ice age. Where we've really had our warm run right now. We should be growing our ice caps again. So the thought was we should be heading that direction. Temperatures were going down. We now know that a lot of the burning and aerosols we were putting in the air in the 1960s and 1950s that weren't controlled were actually having a cooling effect in our upper atmosphere. And strangely enough, with the advent of the Clean Air Act, a lot of that was removed from energy production from coal plants. We started to see that effect disappear. And we started to see the temperature go back up. So there are these interesting little breaks that we didn't know that we were doing. And as we cleaned the air up, we actually saw more solar energy getting through because less of it was getting reflected back to space. You have to be careful. And I'll tell people that if you want, go look at that. The reports, see where they're drawing their science from, see where their sources are from, and always make sure that you dig behind the headline and find out where they're pulling their information from. And then go find out if it's a reputable scientific source or if it's misinterpretation of data.
This has been a great preview of this talk coming up tomorrow night at the River House on the JU campus, free to the public. You want everyone to come out who's interested in this topic?
Yeah, please come out at the JU's River House. It's beautiful. It's a great venue to sit in. And it's going to be an interesting discussion. I welcome anybody who has questions, anybody who has concerns, anybody who's skeptical, come talk to us and we'll see if we can figure out if there's something you can learn or something I can learn.
Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Dr. Jeremy Stalker, ocean geologist at Jacksonville University. Tomorrow night, it's Climate Change, What We Know and Don't Know, a free event at 6 p.m. at the JU campus River House. Well, later in the hour, why magicians are taking over downtown Jacksonville this week with some curious tricks and spells. We'll tell you about it. But up next, marking St. Augustine's historic Freedom Trail. That's in our America's First City in a moment.
Who is your American Graduate Champion? WJCT is looking to recognize and honor a wide range of community leaders and everyday heroes who regularly dedicate their time, talent, and resources to prepare students for success and graduation. American Graduate Champions are role models in their communities whose stories have the potential to inspire others to take action. The nomination deadline is July 15th at 5 p.m. Click the button on WJCT.org to nominate your American Graduate Champion today.
Every day on Morning Edition, it's the news you can't do without.
This morning, we've been looking at what's happening.
There's conservatism, libertarianism, environmentalism, religion.
We're not props. We're just everyday people.
The crowd, the joy, the sense of hope.
Historic.
Listen to the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings beginning at 5 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
WJCT, the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville, and Grassroots Natural Market are accepting submissions from local artists for The Square. The Square is an online venue where local artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJCT-TV and radio. Submit now through July 31st. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
Welcome back. Well, this morning, we're continuing our series, America's First City, by marking news of note in St. Augustine leading up to its amazing 450th commemorations this fall. Now, two important efforts aimed at educating the public about St. Augustine's critical role in the civil rights movement are the work of a local nonprofit. The anniversary to commemorate the civil rights demonstrations, or ACCORD, is behind the historic Freedom Trail in our nation's oldest city and a new civil rights museum. David Nolan, ACCORD member and local historian and author, joins us now with more about the mission to preserve civil rights history in St. Augustine. David, a pleasure to have you on the program.
Pleasure to be here.
So two things to talk about, the Freedom Trail and the Civil Rights Museum. Let's begin with the historic markers of the Freedom Trail. For people that aren't familiar with that project, it's a pretty exciting one.
It really is. And, you know, it was inspired, unfortunately, by the rapid demolition of civil rights landmarks in St. Augustine. And I remember sitting through countless meetings dealing with the demolition of the historic Monson Motel. And at every one, a person from the other side would say, no historic significance, no historic significance.
Really?
And I thought, well, if we put historic markers in front of these places, at least they'll have to think of something else to say. So we were fortunate to get the support of Northrop Grumman Corporation, our largest private employer. And we started in 2007 putting up 10 markers a year. And it, now that we have 30 markers, it really gives you a wonderful range. You know, you can see, for instance, where Martin Luther King stayed, where Dr. Robert Hailing, the leader of the local movement, had his home shot up. You can see institutions like St. Paul AME Church, where Jackie Robinson spoke. And you can see places where people were arrested, like the old Woolworths building, and where they were incarcerated. The old jail building now has a Freedom Trail marker on it.
So people can actually take a walking tour for part of this trail and just and educate themselves about it.
And we even have modern technology that's beyond me, of the kind that you can, you know, type in some numbers on your cell phone, and you can actually hear some of the veterans of that time speaking about what happened on that particular site. So it's like kind of, we think of it as an open-air 24/7 museum that charges you no admission, which is rare in St. Augustine.
That's true. So that's one piece of what you've been doing. The other is the new Accord Civil Rights Museum. This was sometime in the making. Pretty exciting that it's opening up just in time for the 450th celebrations. Tell us about the museum.
Well, you know, I was kind of surprised. It opened on July 2nd last year, which was the 50th anniversary of the signing of the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1964. And it hadn't occurred to us, but we were told by people in Tallahassee that this is the first civil rights museum in the state of Florida.
Get out of here.
And the location is perfect because it is the old dental office of Dr. Robert Hailing. You know, if you go in the state capitol building in Tallahassee today and you turn left down towards the governor's office, one of the first things you will see is a bronze plaque honoring Dr. Hailing as a member of the Florida Civil Rights Hall of Fame. So you can go to St. Augustine, and you can see his old dental office, and inside it are many of the treasures from the civil rights era of the 1960s.
And you learn about Hailing's pivotal role. He personally persuaded MLK to come to St. Augustine and speak, correct?
Yes, he did. And, you know, events happened. Because that was his office, they had many of the strategy meetings for the civil rights movement there. And I remember the late Mrs. Catherine Twine telling me that she was there one day in that office with Dr. Hailing and Dr. Martin Luther King, and the owner of a local tourist attraction came in with a gun. And he said, "Dr. King, I came here today to kill you." He said, "But I can't do it. Because when I look at you, I see that you are a God-sent man." And you know, a few years back, I was giving a tour during the annual Lincolnville Festival, and I told that story, and a woman came up to me afterwards and said, "You know, I was the nurse for that man in his last days, and he told me that same story. It just sent chills down my spine."
It's incredible that even today in 2015, people still aren't aware of St. Augustine's story in the way that, say, they know of Selma, Alabama.
This is true. It's been said that St. Augustine is the most famous place you never heard of in the civil rights
movement.
That's
right. That's right.
And, you know, there were two really major laws that came out of the civil rights movement. One was the Voting Rights Act that came out of Selma in 1965, but the other was the Civil Rights Act that came directly out of St. Augustine. So we are foolish. You know, in St. Augustine, we are used to blowing our own horn, whether true or not. But here is a case where we've waited half a century, and we're still kind of behind the times.
But thanks to your work, these wrongs historically are being corrected. So as people prepare to celebrate the 450th in St. Augustine, you want them to make the Freedom Trail and the Civil Rights Museum part of what they come in
to definitely see. You'll be missing some of the best of what we have to offer, and you can go on the internet nowadays, or the interwebs, as our old timers call it, and you can just type in accordfreedomtrail.org, and up will pop the sights of the Freedom Trail and announcements of events that are happening and pictures of some of the things. We've had wonderful people to come back to St. Augustine over the years and their stories about them on that website.
And then the Civil Rights Museum, by the way, is at 79 Bridge Street in St. Augustine. The Freedom Trail, as you pointed out, you have to walk that, but it's free. So as you visit St. Augustine, take note of these really important historical markers put together by people like you, David, and others who've done just incredible work. So kudos.
Well, thank you very much.
And we're back in a moment.
America's First City is sponsored by the St. Augustine 450th Commemoration and Tapestry Exhibition.
Need some me time? Join Baptist Health and WJZT for our annual health event, Girls Day Out, Saturday, August 15th at the Hyatt Hotel. Be inspired with local and national speakers discussing everything from healing touch to a money boot camp. Be pampered with makeovers, massage, and a gift bag. Be nourished with breakfast and lunch. It's all good for you. Tickets and info at wjct.com/BaptistGoodForYou or call 904-549-2938.
On the next Fresh Air, medical marijuana. Is it effective? If so, for what symptoms? And is it safe? We talk with Dr. David Kasseret about his new book, Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. He directs the Hospice and Palliative Care Program at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
WJCT's new weekend programs are here. Tune in to 89.9 Saturday and Sunday for brand new shows and old favorites at a new time. Join us for True Stories Told Live on the Moth Radio Hour, live comedy and music on Wits, and Storytelling with a Beat on Snap Judgment. Learn more and see the new schedule at wjct.org/weekends.
Welcome back. Well, join us for an uplifting day of health and wellness at WJCT's Girls Day Out event coming up next month. The morning keynote speaker, Jessie Close, a mental health advocate and noted public speaker. As an ambassador for Bring Change to Mind, a nonprofit founded by Jessie's sister, actress Glenn Close, Jessie fights stigma and misunderstanding to create a clearer picture of mental disorders. I spoke with her about her mission.
Jessie Close, welcome to the program. A pleasure to be with you.
Thank you.
It's so exciting to have you as our keynote at WJCT's Good For You Girls Day Out. In particular, the topic of mental illness is one that will interest so many. Let's talk about your story. As a teen, you dropped out of high school, struggled for years without a diagnosis, and finally received one. Can you tell us what that process, I know it's a long process, but can you give us a window into what that process was like?
Well, let's see, I'm going to turn 62 on the 17th of this month, and I wasn't diagnosed till I was 50, so there was a lot of misery. There was also some happiness in there, too. I mean, but... It was difficult. Life was difficult. And getting properly diagnosed and getting on the right medication was literally a lifesaver.
Sure. A life-altering.
Yeah.
And why do you think still in 2015 we still as a nation are having such a difficult time getting people the correct diagnosis and treatment?
You know, lots of people are just not open to hearing about mental illness. Just the other day, I went to see a podiatrist. I've been having trouble with my foot. And, you know, you have to write down all your medications, and no matter who you're seeing. And so I did. And I mentioned to him that I lived with bipolar 1 disorder and that my son lives with schizophrenia. And his face just went blank.
Mm-hmm.
And I've experienced this a lot. People just don't want to, they don't want to hear about it. They don't know how to accept someone who is sitting across from them saying that they live with a mental illness. It would probably be easier to say I had heart disease.
Right.
And, oh yeah, my so-and-so had heart disease. Some people, when I open up to them, they'll say, oh yeah, my Aunt Jenny was really crazy. They use the word crazy a lot. And that's too bad, because it's an illness and it can be treated with medication just like any other illness.
Right.
Then there are the people who, think, oh no, you don't need medication for a mental illness. You need, you need therapy of some kind, or, you know, if you get acupuncture, or, you know, which I don't mean to be putting acupuncture down. Acupuncture is fabulous, but you need medication. That's all there is to it.
Tell me a little bit about the organization that you and your sister actress, Glenn Close, are involved with. It's called Bring Change to Mind to Fight Stigma and Misunderstanding around Mental Disorders. Tell us a little bit about Bring Change to Mind.
Change to Mind is a fabulous organization. Pamela Harrington runs our office in San Francisco, and we are up to 75,000 members. Several of us write blogs. There's a new blog every month. And Bring Change to Mind grapples with stigma in a very hands-on way. We just started a new high school program, which is going to be going into the schools and talking about mental illness and allowing kids to talk about their experiences without stigma. It's a very hands-on, inclusive organization. And my son Kalen and I are ambassadors. We have a couple new ambassadors also. And by that, you know, like what I'm doing with you guys next month.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing you here on the 15th of August, Jesse Close. Yes. We thank you so much for giving us a few minutes.
Well, you're very, very welcome.
That's Jesse Close. She'll be the morning keynote at WJCT's Girls Day Out Good For You event coming up Saturday, August 15th at the Downtown Hyatt. Get your tickets at wjct.org/goodforyou. And we're back in a moment.
Relax around the clock with the music of your life. Playing great music from Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald to James Taylor, Joni Mitchell, and more. Relax Radio, WJCT, 89.9 HD3. Learn more at wjct.org/relax.
Never know how much I love you.
A traveling exhibit currently at the Brooklyn Museum is showcasing a wearable kind of art, sneakers.
This is dope to see right here.
Air Jordan 1.
1985. Great year for sneakers, great year for Jordan.
A tour through the history and culture of the sneaker later on All Things Considered from NPR News. Weekdays at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Hi, I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
And we're the guys from Deemable Tech.
Hey, if you've got a question about your computer, mobile phone, tablet, or the internet...
And who doesn't?
We're here to help.
Join us Thursdays during Morning Edition and All Things Considered here on WJCT.
And check out our podcast online at deemable.com.
That's deemable.com.
WJCT and Community First Credit Union are proud to announce that Mary Enworth will be this year's morning keynote speaker at Teach. Mary is co-author of Pathways to the Common Core. She is deputy director of middle schools at the Teachers Reading and Writing Project, Columbia University. Mary is just one of the many great speakers you will hear throughout the day. For more information or to purchase tickets, go to wjct/teach.
Well, finally this hour, this week, Jacksonville just might disappear, or at least some of the regular old Jacksonville landmarks could vanish, because hundreds of musicians from all over the world will be in town for the 87th annual convention of the International Brotherhood of Magicians. It's another IBM. Joe Turner, Chief Impossibility Officer for the organization, is here with a preview of the tricks and spells that will be cast over our city. Hey, Joe.
Good morning.
You're the chief impossibility officer. I love that title.
Well, thank you. That's personal for my business. I am the incoming international president for our organization, and we are so excited to be in Jacksonville.
Now, how did the IBM, the world's largest magic organization, pick Jacksonville for its annual convention? It's the first time you've come to town.
It is the first time we've been in Jacksonville, although we have been in Florida a few times in the past. In fact, the very first IBM convention that I ever attended was in Central Florida many years ago, but we have a site selection group, and we try to position our convention in different parts of the country so that our members have a good opportunity to travel and visit and be part of our festivities. And it was a good time to get back to the South, and we took a look at Jacksonville and thought, this is great. What a beautiful theater. Florida Theater is such a gem, and the Hyatt is a wonderful facility for what we need. So we're pleased to be here.
You're going to be at the Hyatt downtown on the riverfront, and also three big magic shows at the Florida Theater. What can we be looking forward to?
Well, the shows that we've got coming up at the theater are Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights at 8 o'clock. Thursday night, we've got the Shenanigans Show, and this is a comedy, magic, juggling extravaganza. They're subtitling it Magic and Mischief, and so you can expect that one to be sort of wacky, zany fun. Then we've got our international competition on Friday night at 8 o'clock. So magicians from all over the country and around the world will be competing for our highest awards in stage magic. And then Saturday night is our grand finale show, another wonderful combination of magic, comedy, and illusions. All of these are family-friendly. Check Ticketmaster.
Very nice. And for people that want to learn the art of magic, there will be classes around that too, right?
Well, for our members who are attending the convention, we do have, like any association, our association has 10,000 members in 88 countries, and it's designed to promote and extend the art of magic. We will have continuing education, you might call it, lectures and classes. We have sort of a vendor trade show area where dealers in magic and spells will be presenting their wares, and it's going to be a great time.
It sounds amazing, and this is something that I think has appeal to so many people. And there's this curiosity about how you don't want to give away the magic. You don't want to give away how you do these tricks. You want to preserve some of the illusion.
Well, magic sort of works by the fact that we're creating this unexpected result. And so when the world stops working the way you've been acclimated, the way you're accustomed to seeing it work, it changes the way you pay attention. It opens your eyes. It creates this moment of astonishment. Or how can that be? And in a world that is so permeated by digital magic and devices that can answer any question, to have your world rocked by a piece of string or a playing card can be a wonderful experience.
Is that what drew you to doing magic tricks?
It is. When I got into magic when I was a kid, I was about 5 years old and got a little magic set for Christmas. And it's fun to be able to do something that how it works is hidden, and people causes people to pay attention and wonder how that can possibly be. And that's very empowering for a young person. We have a great program for young people and for teens right now at the convention. We have a teen program, Lance Burton Teen Seminar, which is going on right now to really cultivate that interest and build those skills in our young people, our college-bound people. And magic is a great way to stand out when you're making those scholarship applications as well.
Oh, that's a good tip, isn't it?
It is indeed.
But if you just are the casual fan, you need to come out to three evening magic shows this week, the 16th through the 18th at the Florida Theater, because hundreds of magicians from around the world are coming to town this week. Keep your eye out for them. They might be casting some spells all over the urban core.
It'll be a great time. Be ready to pick a card if you see us.
Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. Check Ticketmaster.
He's Joe Turner. And again, this is the IBM's convention in Jacksonville. Get ready for some magic. That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Shevchuk. If you miss a live show, you can always get our podcasts. They're now up on iTunes and Stitcher. Next on Diane Rehm, former Virginia Senator Jim Webb talks about the future of the Democratic Party and his bid to be the 2016 Democratic nominee for president. That's next I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.